It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And joining me in studio, one of the usual suspects, IFJA's Dapper Dan, Chris Lloyd.
How you doing? It's good to be here.
It's good to have you back here. There are times I feel like we almost become a boy band because you're the best dressed one of the group. I'm the court jester. Richard is transportation. Ed's the elder statesman, followed by Bob.
I was going to say, like, who in the usual suspect? Like, how would we divide ourselves
up? Oh,
no.
Up? Oh, those usual suspects. Oh, I don't know. See, I would, since I have the name Sosi, I think I know who I am.
Yeah.
But I have no allegations. Yeah, I don't know. I think Gabriel Byrne was the best dressed one of the suspects. So it's probably, but you're irritated because you think you're Kaiser Soze in real
life. Everyone wants to be Kaiser Soze. Why wouldn't you?
I don't know.
He's the cool one.
That means Emma must be Kobayashi. my daughter is Pete Postlethwaite. So there's that. All right. We are in the midst of, we were talking earlier of the first world problems that IS film critics have. And it's the never-ending mailing and email sense of award screeners. So we are gearing up for that for the big December summit meeting, which someday we should televise.
Yeah, which is actually, I think, a month from today, if I've got the date right.
Right. So we are going in between grown-up movie season and, of course, what's opening in theaters this week. So full disclosure, my daughter and I are working on a play that opens in a few weeks. We're in a production of Peter and the Starcatcher, which at Richmond Civic, which means my evenings are shot, so I get to see the guys at morning screenings and times like this. So, Chris, you saw Justice League. I guess the first question is it better than Batman versus Superman?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I liked Justice League. I gave it a positive review. Seems like I'm looking at Rotten Tomatoes and certainly looking at my Facebook feed from some of our local boys.
And Evan just really took it to task.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think he's hated all the DC Comics movies. I guess I sort of did grade it on a curve a little bit. I compared it to Man of Steel, which I thought was a noble failure, and then Batman vs. Superman, which I thought was very disappointing.
Does anybody die for our sins in this one?
No.
Okay.
And no one comes together over the name Martha.
Now, does it come close to Wonder Woman?
No. Wonder Woman is great. It's not in my top 10, but certainly would probably be like that next tier down of movies of the year.
The Hall of Very Good.
I wouldn't even call it very good. I call it, you know, pretty good.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, when you're looking at the predecessors, pretty good looks pretty good.
Well, I would say Wonder Woman's in the Hall of Very Good.
Yeah, I would say so too.
Jim Rice.
Yeah.
For you Hall of Fame fans out there. So, okay, I guess I got to ask because we've seen the trailers and Gary Clark Jr.'s use of Come Together, and yes, there's J.K. Simmons. Who the hell's the villain in this? Because it it's basically DC's Avengers, and that's why we should go see this.
Right, you know, and there, of course, you know, the first Avengers, you had Loki as the bad guy with his alien help. You know, for me, a lot of films rise or fall on the basis of the villain. And the villain here is, I mean, it's not that he's bad, he's just kind of forgettable. I had never heard of him. Granted, it's been a while since I stopped reading comic books. His name's Steppenwolf. I looked up the character's genesis.
It's John Malkovich.
Yeah.
John Kay.
The character was created in 1972, which is the same year that the middling Canadian rock band disbanded.
Right.
So people have claimed it's based on the book from like 1927.
He's born to be wild. We know.
Yeah, I don't know. And he's like this, you know, he's just a generic doombringer. He's just, you know, guy who literally teleports in from nowhere. No one's ever heard of him. Like, hey, I'm back and I'm here to take over the world and turn it into a bad place and get my, you know, three MacGuffins that you're all going to go chase after that we've got to put together to make the mother. I'm trying to remember the language. It's like the mother stones, and they put them together, and it's going to bring about the unity. And
I was capital T, capital U.
Yeah, and I was just like, why do they have all these like nice, beautiful, soothing names for end time gadgets in all these movies?
Irony.
Yeah, I know. You know, the hellacious doombringer. Why can't we call it that?
That's also a linebacker, I believe.
Yeah. And one thing else that struck me about him is that he keeps, you know, criticizing or, you know, demeaning them as like, you know, like as being like primitive humans and primitive heroes and all these things. And he's a guy with a Viking helmet and an axe. And I was like, okay, if you're so advanced, you know, where's the laser? Where's the mind scrambler ray? He's just a guy swinging an axe.
He's going to beat them at their own game.
Yes. And there is a surprise that comes about halfway to two-thirds of the way through the movie, which I've been having this debate on social media the last couple of days. In that, like, I don't think we should spoil it for them.
Of course not.
Other than just say, you know, even just saying there's a surprise. I mean, every movie tries to have surprises.
Right.
But I don't think it'll be that big of a surprise to most people. But still, it's like what I've been telling people is definitely the trailers are safe. The posters are safe. Just do not do a Google image search for Justice League before you go see the movie if you do not want to have this quote-unquote surprise spoiled.
Which is why I look at Gal Gadot photos just normal, Google image. Yeah, I'm a pig guy who likes Wonder Woman, whatever. So is the first half like the setup where everybody gets together to fight the common enemy?
Pretty much. It's what it is. So, you know, we basically at the end of Batman versus Superman have Superman is killed at the end of the last movie, Batman versus Superman, but he more or less convinces Wonder Woman to join his team that does not yet exist. So she's kind of already in as his first recruit. And what's interesting is that Bruce Wayne, you know, he's older. This is the older, grizzly version of Bruce Wayne. He really wants Wonder Woman to take over Superman's spot as, you know, the big inspiring figure who will lead the team. Because he kind of has he has enough self-awareness to know that, you know, brooding Bat Boy.
He's older guy. Older guy.
You know, darkness, no parents,
right.
As the Black Batman Lego movie put it. Not good for that role. So they bring in, you know, and it's mostly about them trying to recruit these people and being rejected. With the notable exception of the Flash, who is a great little thing where he starts to make his, you know, his spiel and his pitch, and the Flash played by Ezra Miller is just like, I'm in. You know, sign me up. I'm in.
So it's an homage to Mystery Men?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit. And they've got Cyborg, again, a comics hero that I think most people, you know, is not top of mind like the others. But he's basically like an Iron Man, but he can't take off the suit.
Sure.
And it's like he's discovering new abilities that his body has that he didn't know about. And then Aquaman, we've got to talk about Aquaman. I've lost count here of like the sixth or seventh blonde male superhero that has now been turned into a brunette, played by Jason Momoa.
Full disclosure, Christopher Lloyd is also our blonde activist.
I am the self-appointed grand vizier of blondness.
You cannot be an assassin. And apparently now we have an Aquaman rant.
Yeah, and so he's getting on. We did it to Captain America. We did it to the Human Torch. I've lost count of the others. So now he does a little bit of like sun-kissed thing going on, but it comes and goes. He's got dark hair, but it's like long dark hair, and he's all tatted up, and he's like nasty and antisocial. So he's like it's like Aquaman as surly biker dude.
But does he do things? Because that's always the big joke is that Aquaman doesn't do anything.
Well, there's like one underwater sequence in the movie, which is just long enough for us to say like, okay, this is why this hero can't take place underwater. And there's like no talking with the fishes or anything like that.
And no swimming with the fishes.
So he's basically just like a big, strong dude with a trident. That's his power.
He'll be on a can of beer in Lawrence.
Yeah. So the Aquaman definitely didn't do it for me. But I did like the fact that the movie took the time to like give each character a little bit of his or her own scene, you know, a little bit of time to show their heart. And it's not just 2 hours of combat.
By the way, we're still waiting for the backstory for the gang from Rogue One. Maybe in the next picture.
Well, they're all dead now. So.
Well, the United Colors of whatever. So, okay. So
I like Justice League. It's a fun movie. It's a little bit goofy. But I mean,
like good goofy. I mean, this is also Zack Snyder directing it, don't know what kind of goofy gets
with Guardians of the Galaxy and now subsequent films, Deadpool. I mean, we're very firmly into the comedy section of the superhero genre.
Suicide Squad. This,
yeah. I mean, it's like comedy humor is going to be part and parcel of every comic book movie going forward until the next reckoning, and it goes back to being all grim and dark.
Happens. Okay, there are two acting Ferraris in this film. Do they get to be utilized? Amy Adams and J.K. Simmons.
Oh, Simmons is very underutilized in the film. I mean, like, as Commissioner Gordon, like he literally has two or three scenes.
I want a Yoda scene with him, either in the second or the third film, where like, oh, that's why he's here.
He shows up, he flips on the bat light, and that's about it. The bat signal, and that's about it.
And he'll make more money with this than he did Whiplash.
Yeah, and Amy Adams is Lois Lane. She's got not a lot of screen time, along with her with Diane Lane playing Clark Kent's mom. But it's good stuff. You know, they're sort of dealing with Superman's death, and I like the fact that they include that in there. That they're not just sort of, well, he's dead, so we don't need his you know girlfriend and mom anymore, that they're given some time to do some things. Our friend Evan Dossi ran on Facebook
really
today,
which
I'm not understanding about some what he claims is a very gross, ribald joke at Lois Lane's expense, which I think he's just wrong. I think he read the line of dialogue wrong, but I think that just sort of got swept up in his all-consuming hatred for the film.
Check out Evan Dossi on Facebook. It's quite a thing of white heat.
Yes,
online.
And don't let us make mistakes. So he's got his own new website.
He does.
Out. Is it MidwestFilmJournal.com?
Yes.
So go check that out to hear his views, even though they are entirely wrong.
And the man in the jacket and the sweater says so. So there's that. All right, shifting gears a little bit to Lady Bird, the new film written and directed by Greta Gerwig. And it's funny because we were walking out of the screen, we're like, it's so not the Greta Gerwig story. We'll see. It's about a high school senior at a Catholic school in Sacramento, which is where Gerwig is from. Her doppelganger this time is Saoirse Ronan. And I say so not. It's one of those like we know where she got the inspiration from. This
yeah.
We think.
I think I heard on
Fresh
WFYI
Air.
We had an interview with her yesterday, which I only got to hear a little bit of it. But I mean, it sounds like clearly she took pieces of her own life.
Correct.
And sort of impose this on this created character and this created family. So it's not an autobiography of her, but certainly it's like every Stephen King book, there's something about Maine and Bangor and,
right.
Like that. I mean, I was listening to her talk to Terry Gross, she was really into fencing in high school, and obviously the character does not do that.
Right.
This is one of my absolute favorite films of the year. In fact, I did a mock early top 10 list, and like if I was doing my top 10 list today, which I did leave Baby Driver off of accidentally, if I was making it today, Lady Bird would be my number 2.
Wow.
I love this film.
It is. I think it would be on a great double feature with Edge of 17. As far as fine representation of teen angst in high school.
Yeah, not too many people remind me the actress's name in Edge of 17.
Hailee Steinfeld.
Yes, not too many people got to see that one.
And hopefully they should. This is, if you know Greta Gerwig's work, because she's best known, obviously, for her work with Noah Baumbach.
She's known as an actress, and then she started co-writing the screenplays of the film she was acting in, and now she's not in this movie at all. She's completely directing and writing.
Correct. And so I would say, this would be, if you want to do a triple feature of this Francis Ha, and then Mistress America, where they're not the same character, but you could see a similar. She was in last year's 20th Century Women as well.
Just great movies, and this one, you know, filled with these female characters who are strong and yet full of contradictions.
Yes,
and you know they. They have moments of neuroses. They have moments of great bravery, often one following the other. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on in here. It's about her entire senior year. And so, you know, there's like the typical falling for a boy, you know, breaking up with the boy, getting back with the boy, finding another boy. You know, that kind of stuff is in there. But it's really more about her struggling to establish an identity that is not based on her mother. You know, so at first she's very much doing everything in opposition to whatever my mother defines me as. I will be the opposite of that.
In fact, there's a great scene early on, and her mother is played by Laurie Metcalf,
who's terrific, who I think
will finally get a nomination
this year.
If she
does not get an Oscar nomination, it'll be a crime.
She's got the 1-2 punch of it's a really good performance, and everybody really likes her, and she's had a solid, solid career of film, TV, and stage. But there's an argument with her mother in the car, and not since Crazy Stupid Love, because apparently this is the device of I'm going to hop out of the car right now. You're not going to hop out of the car. And sure enough, she does.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me watching this is nothing rang of a John Hughes film. And yeah, I think John Hughes is slightly overrated. So, and none of that happens in this. And I think, that means quite a bit. Because there's enough, like I said, there's great contradictions between everybody. As far as there's the only quibble I remember, and it's not really, I don't want to give away too much, but yeah, she has a crush on a boy. It's the young gentleman from
Hedges.
Thank you, from Manchester by the Sea, and
nice performance. Did not deserve an Oscar nomination.
Oh, come on. It's
compared to who else was up
who
there?
Who would you replace?
Oh, I'm
smart
trying.
Guy. I know we said
I don't remember. I'd have to go look at my rants from last year.
Don't worry. He will email me his answer later this weekend. but there's the only quibble is a scene where it's a Steadicam following her into finding out a secret about her boyfriend.
Yeah.
A little forced. That's the only quibble I really have with the film.
Yeah.
Other than that, everything from, you know, dealing with the school play, being with one group of friends, and then winding up going with a different crowd, but it doesn't go into 13 territory. Just your own friendships and alliances and devotions change even in the span of a school year.
Like there's this girl that she sort of we need to come up with a word for this
bad
in English
girl.
Language where it's like. You make fun of someone because you secretly are very envious of them.
Sports callers.
Or even not necessarily secretly envious. So there's a character in this film played by Odeya Rush that, like, you know, they hate her. She's like the rich, perfect girl. When you first meet her, the Ladybird character, and her best friend is played by, I can't remember the actress's name, is Beanie, because I can't remember that. Forget that first name.
Right.
But I can't remember. She's terrific playing the best friend as well. And they're like talking bad about her, but also be like, you know, like, her skin just glows.
it's Benedict and Beatrice, basically.
And without giving anything away, you know, there becomes a point in the film where she starts to try and insert herself into that perfect girl's social circle and has some success doing it. And, you know, and of course, you know, as grown-ups, we'd be like, you know, the contradiction of you hated that girl, but now you're kowtowing to her. But I mean, that's life when you're 17,
and it's not you describe it that way, and it's not a single white female slant on that. It's just it's just a kid's decisions, not always the best. Hunting for School, Terry Letts, who's had quite a good year as an actor between this and The Lovers.
Yeah, usually plays jerks, and here he plays the dad,
not a lunkhead dad,
not the lunkhead sitcom dad. Which, you know, that worked for a while, but I think we're all starting sort of kind of getting tired of, like, every dad on TV and movies being a Homer Simpson clone.
Well, you know, white men are the oppressed.
Yes, we are, but not so much. But, you know, hey, cut us a little break. But, he plays the dad here. And, I mean, he's definitely a background character, and it's like that sort of perfect level of, you know, he shows up. We get just enough to see that he has his own identity and his own things going on inside of his head.
Yep.
But, you know, understanding that he's there. And the thing is, like, the mother and the daughter, they're just constantly fighting, and not like nice fighting. I mean, like nasty, mean. You hate me. Like the mother at several point tells her, like, why even bother going to college because you're just going to end up in jail. I mean, nasty stuff,
ugly stuff.
And his role is to sort of be, is that I love my wife, I love my daughter, and I'm not going to take sides here, and I'm going to find some way to support both of them. Even as I understand that they're going to have to work out this issue between themselves.
Yep, there's that. And then when you see this, and you really should see this, there's a great scene with Laurie Metcalf in a car.
Yeah,
and it's everything about Steppenwolf training, because these are characters we know: the mom, the dad, the best friend, the bad influence, everything. We've seen this in hundreds of films and hundreds of TV shows. But not like this.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the film so much fun to watch. But yeah, there's a wonderful less is more scene involving Laurie Metcalf in a car near the end. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about when you see it.
Yeah, I had the strangest recall when I saw that. Was it reminded me of the last scene in a movie that probably most people never saw or forgotten about from the 80s called The Last American Virgin.
Okay, not quite that big a kick in the chest, but I know where you're going.
Yeah, just the
bad use of James Ingram afterwards, and you know what it is? It's we'll get back to it, but it's like Where the Boys Are.
Oh yeah,
90% of this film, and in the case of Last American Virgin, 90% of this film is this Porky's horny teenager movie, and then you're like, hey, this actually has a little more heart and a little more depth to it, and then you're kicked in the chest.
Yeah.
It's like a heel turn in wrestling.
Well, I like Fast Times at Ridgemont High is sort of, the grand king daddy of that thing of, like, you think you're getting something, and you do get that thing to a certain extent, but the movie actually...
A smart, horny teenager
sort of, movie. It sort of coaxes you along, and like, oh, by the way, while you're here for all the stuff that we know you were coming for, we're actually going to tell a serious story. Yep. And give you some vibrant characters.
Where the Boys Are looks like every other Frankie in that beach, spring break movie of the 1950s and 60s, and then there's a rape. I see the connection there. Is Last American Virgin on video?
I literally probably have not seen it, in at least 25 years.
It was one of those films that was on cable constantly.
Right, it was on HBO.
My only thing about probably is song copyrights.
Yeah.
You'd have to, because I had a wall-to-wall soundtrack.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Laurie Metcalf, you were saying.
Laurie Metcalf, yeah, terrific. I mean, it really is one of those sort of career capper type of performances that you hope will lead to more things. I mean, she's been around, been a name because the TV show that she was on.
Shows.
But like, sort of like Melissa Leo, I'm hoping that's like, someone's been around forever, and this will give her, so now we'll start seeing her in other movies, supporting roles in big profile films from time.
Or just give her a giant ass role on Broadway and just have at it.
Yeah.
So
definitely Lady Bird, do not miss.
Do not miss. And the name comes from, of course, the young girl that wants to be identified and be addressed as Lady Bird. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So, all right.
All right. Let's do a fun thing here.
Yes, sir.
Say something weird about yourself from high school that people would not have known about. Just to show that, like, every kid is weird when you're in high school.
Oh, God. Too much. No, that's too much cologne. Is that
too much cologne?
Is that weird enough for you?
I was listening to another Terry Gross interview with the... I'm forgetting him now. But the guy who was the I'm a PC in the Mac and PC commercials.
Oh, yes. That kid. That guy.
That guy. He's about our age now. Actually, a little bit younger.
Is he?
Yeah, he was talking about it in high school. He dressed, in like Doctor Who.
Oh, I wore a pinstripe vest constantly.
Yeah.
My junior and senior year, I was in a production of The Odd Couple. And my fashion influence. Yes, this was my first fashion influence, ladies and gentlemen. Art Carney in the 1950s.
Oh, yeah.
So, because of the Honeymooners. So, for The Odd Couple, I took my dad's pinstripe vest because nobody was wearing vests. Nobody were wearing vests in the 80s. And I had these charcoal pants, plain white T-shirt, and the low leather boots with the zipper on the side. Thanks, Dad. And the vest just became a trademark my last year and a half or so of high school.
Yeah.
What was yours?
The entirety of ninth grade, I wore a coat to school every day, just like a jacket, you know.
Like now.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is, you know, Florida. So I did not need a jacket.
And shorts.
Except for like 6 weeks out of the year. And I did that to cover up the fact that, big surprise, I was bullied a lot in school. I know, hard to believe that people who end up as film critics and radio hosts were the types that were bullied. So I wore the jacket to conceal the fact that I was carrying around with me a wooden stick that I used, that I carried with me, that I was going to defend myself with, against all the bullies. And I stenciled onto the stick the word Putz Crusher.
Wow.
Yes. My entire ninth grade year, wore a jacket every day with the Putz Crusher concealed as my weapon.
You'd have been a news item.
I know. Needless to say, no putzes were actually crushed.
You know why? Because they feared you. You were like Bernard Goetz. Finally the time when somebody would approach you, you're like, yes.
More like Michael Douglas in Falling Down, yeah.
I had that moment. Not related to this, but Bobcat Goldthwait talked about Bernard Goetz and of course the subway vigilante from the 80s when somebody finally approached him. And he's like, you're thinking Goetz probably was riding subways for weeks thinking he was Charles Bronson waiting for somebody to happen, and then when finally he was approached, he was like, yes, yeah. Oh, this feels so good. For me, there is a community theater in Indianapolis, Mud Creek Players. And people there, audience members, sometimes have a tendency to not only put their feet up on the stage, but put their crap up on the stage. Purses, cups, not kidding. This, I mean, like it's their counter space. And I was directing the Three Musketeers, and I had to come out to do the curtain speech. And I come out to greet the audience, and there's a woman with her feet on the stage. I really wanted to quote Madeleine Kahn in Blazing Saddles, but I was slightly nicer. But it was that moment of, now's the time. Now's my chance. And I said to the lady, I'm sorry, are you in the show? Then get your feet off the stage. It felt so damn good. So I guess, in a way, I'm glad you didn't have to bash any putzes, but wow. And look how you've turned out. You're all right.
Yep, I still would probably run away if I saw a bully, though.
Well, they're on the internet, so yeah. They're not leaving their houses. It's okay. Okay, shifting gears once again. We have now reached it's 2017, and Julia Roberts is playing mom roles now. So and every kid's going to be asking her to prom. She is
turned 50 a couple of weeks
ago.
Yeah.
So there you go, guys.
The grandmother roles are not far away.
Feisty grandmother roles. But in this film, Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson equal wonder, basically. And you saw this one. Take the reins on this.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing too... I like the fact this movie was straightforward about what it is, and it was never ironic or coy. It's like, I am a tearjerker. Tears shall be jerked.
You say that a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's in the sound archive here, but yeah.
Yeah, and so the good thing is it stars Jacob Tremblay, of course, was so great in Room from a couple years ago.
Ah, that's right.
He plays a boy who's going 10 years old, going into fifth grade, and he was born with severe facial deformities. He's had like 27 surgeries, I think is the number in the movie. But he's been homeschooled by his mom, played by Julia Roberts, who kind of put her life and academic career on hold to do that. And so it follows him during his year of fifth grade. Two films that, you know, follow someone during a year of their schooling. And obviously he's tremendously, I mean, he's not like physically abused, but he's emotionally abused to a great extent, stared at, poked. Obviously a couple of boys kind of take him on his wing, but also befriends a kid, then that befriends another kid. And so there's like, you know, feeling of hope. And then, there's a point midway through the film where hope is withdrawn and he goes back into a dark place. So, I mean, it's not a sophisticated film. It's based, I understand it, on a best-selling book. But it's made by the guy I've seen so many movies this week that I'm misremembering names. I was about to say the guy who directed In Bruges, but no, that's another
Martin,
film.
That's not the guy. Stephen Chbosky.
Yeah, and I think he made The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Yes.
Which is a terrific
another terrific high school film.
Yeah. And this isn't obviously in that league, but it's well done. The performances, you got Julia Roberts, Owen Wilson, and there's also a gal who plays his big sister who's in going into high school herself. And the film actually takes away from not just the kid to kind of follow the people in his orbit. As the sister says, you know, he is the sun and we are all the moons, you know, reflecting his light just because he takes up so much attention of everyone's lives. And we get to see a little bit of themselves away from just being their relationship with the kid. Augie is his name. And so It's a well-done film. It's not particularly sophisticated about what it does, but it does what it does very well.
All right. Also opening this weekend, if you needed an animated film about the birth of Christ, the film called The Star.
Right. It's The Birth of Christ, animated film, as seen from the perspective of all the critters. So, like, you know, in the manger, it's
with
like the camels
voices.
And the cows and like this.
That's fine.
It's got some big names. Oprah Winfrey doing a voice, a few others.
I bet she's also threw some dollars in there.
Yeah, possibly.
Keegan-Michael Key, yeah. I know, is in it. His voice is in it. Christopher Plummer, Ving Rhames, Gabriel Iglesias, Kelly Clarkson, Anthony Anderson.
Yes, and this is not Christopher Plummer doing a sub-in job for Kevin Spacey in this case.
Or the Onion article where 4,000 people have been replaced by Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
Chris Christopherson, Kristen Chenoweth, Mariah Carey. So, not necessarily great voice artists, but they're known voices.
Yeah, not screened for critics. I mean, I'm not being nasty, but this is clearly like, you know, third tier animation. Not from a DreamWorks or a Pixar, Disney,
and I'll say it, and the faith based audience.
Yeah, so it's clearly a faith based film, trying to do it, you know, the fun version of Jesus for kids.
Okay,
haven't seen it. I probably won't see it, but we'll.
And it's just we got stuff to review. We got stuff in the mail.
Well, you know, I always respect films that are willing to show themselves, be shown to critics beforehand for their review, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Yep.
I mean,
be on the lookout for, I guess it was just because we were talking about this off air, but be on the lookout for The Square, if you like a parody, satire of art.
Which I thought I was instructed and told was coming out this week, so I posted my review.
And then,
But that, of course, it was the Palme d'Or winner from this year's Cannes Film Festival, and it's actually a good one, and it's actually getting a wide release in the United States. Lately, the Cannes Film Festival kind of like just they've taken left turns. That they're just like, we want to do obscure films. Like, quick, name last year's Palme d'Or winner.
I have no idea.
Daniel Blake.
Wow.
Exactly.
Look at that.
I had to Google.
Oh, okay. But he had it right here. Okay. I also want to ask you, because I talked about this on the show last week, about Murder on the Orient Express, which I put it in the same ballpark as Rocky Balboa as the most highly praised mediocre film of the year. And I think part of it was...
Has it been getting good reviews?
It's been getting decent reviews. You can read our colleague Ed Johnson-Ott's review of it in Nuvo. Ed had a good beam on it. He talked about if it goes too far out, then it'll get criticized. And if it stays true to, you know, what I guess the Sidney Lumet film or the TV version with Alfred Molina, then it's a complete retread. I guess what I was wondering is the thing I wish that this thing had more of was fun. I know, and Branagh's fine, and I people went, the internet went crazy with the mustache. That's the least of this film's problems. But I think they gave a different Poirot, and I understand you doing that. But there's a bit of melancholy, which I'm not used to with an Agatha Christie mystery at all, whether it's him or Miss Marple or anybody else. And I guess I'm wondering, am I off base on this?
I have come up from an interesting perspective in that I have not... experienced this work in any form. I have not read the book. I never saw the movie from 1974. I never saw the TV version. So I was coming at it completely fresh.
Okay.
So probably I liked it more than most in that because, you know, it's an Agatha Christie story, so there's a twist. And it's a very different twist than I've ever seen in a mystery thriller, where it sort of takes the conventions of the genre and upends them.
Totally. I get it.
So for me, that was great to experience. And that was a great gasp moment.
Well, and I said, because I remember, like, the woman next to me had no clue. And I know a lot of people that had not seen the one from 1974. So I'm like, okay, 40 years. It's not Beauty and the Beast, where it was only 20. But the fact that, I guess, if you know going in nothing about it, then, you know, good for you. And good for you in this case. So I remember seeing Death on the Nile and Evil Under the Sun and the Appointment, you know, all the Peter Ustinov ones as a kid, and enjoying the lightness and the fun out of it. This is just Branagh's version, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, definitely a little darker, a little more Sturm und Drang. I like the way he shot it, really using the confined spaces of the train to his effect, and then they go outside the train.
A little too much CG for my taste.
Yeah, you know, and then we sort of, you know, like, they go outside the train, and, oh, things open up for a bit, and then, ooh, we're back in the train.
Yeah.
The thing where he shot several scenes completely from overhead, like straight down,
right. Like
the top of the character's heads as they're moving around the train. That was neat. I was like, I've never seen that before. I love it, even if it's just a little piece of a movie where I can say, I've never seen that before.
Well, there you go. All right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Matthew Soucy here, hanging out with Chris Lloyd of the Film Yet. By the way, yeah, I love the idea that, Get Out got a Golden Globe nomination, but it's not a comedy. And now, of course, the filmmaker is saying it's a documentary.
Well, he's trying to make a point.
He is making a point.
I was surprised by the vehemence with his objection, just because, I mean, you know, usually what's happening here is films that aren't comedies are getting put over there just because it gives them a better chance of winning. And certainly you put Get Out over there with the Golden Globes, it has a much better chance of actually winning the whole dang thing than it does in the drama. I mean,
that being said, there's not a whole lot of laughs in the second half of that film.
Oh, there's a few. I mean, there's one right at the very
end.
Well,
and I think the point is, I guess it's Golden Globes as the old aisles of the video store concept, I guess.
Yeah.
Some things are just a little harder to categorize.
Yeah, I like Get Out. People are praising it as one of the best films of the year. I don't see that. I thought it was a pretty clever, pretty well done, you know, horror film. More like a social commentary wearing the clothes of a horror film.
I think, if I remember correctly, I called it Guess Who's Coming to Dinner Meets the Stepford Wives. And by the way, pardon my allergies. I don't sound like I'm at a debate. All right. Shifting gears to new films on video and Blu-ray. Taylor Sheridan, who's had quite a streak already, probably best known around film nerds as the gentleman who wrote Hell or High Water, one of the big films from last year, wrote Sicario. And this time around, he is writing and directing a piece of mountain noir, as I've heard somebody refer to that.
That's a good word.
Well, Winter's Bone was Ozark noir. Now we have mountain noir with Wind River, with Jeremy Renner as a hunter who's helping out in an investigation of a rape and murder on an Indian reservation. So there's already complexities as far as who gets the rule of
jurisdiction.
Thank you, jurisdiction, yeah. Because you have Indian territory, American territory, and national territory.
Yeah, Graham Greene.
Always good to see Graham Greene. Good to see Gil Birmingham.
Yeah,
who's terrific. Who were
a smaller supporting part, but as you like to say. Like Robert Ory, you know, comes off the bench,
yeah.
hits a pair of threes, sits back down. That was Gilbert.
He has two really good threes in this.
Yes. He's a couple of greases. I really, this film, if I was making my top 10 list, would be on it, probably towards the bottom, but still terrific. You know, Taylor Sheridan has sort of kind of become the oracle of the modern Western now, with these stories of, like, you know, revenge and alienation and... I've heard some people object to this film just because it takes place on a Native American reservation, but it has two Caucasian protagonists. And I think they kind of missed the point with that criticism.
Right, because they're out of... Well, one is out of her element, and the other one knows where he stands in this element.
Right. One, you know, the Jeremy Renner character is very much of that place. He's lived there most of his life. He's married into it. His family is into it. And whereas the FBI agent played by Elizabeth Olsen, she's a great character because she's coming in and she is completely out of her depth, and yet she is smart enough and strong enough to admit, I am out of my depth. Yep. I need help here. And thus she recruits the Jeremy Renner character to kind of be her wingman.
And there was a little bit of online, and there was more, I think, more talk, at least amongst our circle of folks, about cinematic mansplaining because of the Olsen character. And she has the hardest role because she's an FBI agent, she has the most pull, sort of. But she is, as you said, she admits, completely out of her element as far as even something as simple as what to wear, how to react. There's a great standoff because you have an FBI agent, a Indian reservation liaison, the Graham Greene character, Jeremy Renner's character, and a corporation that really feels that they rule anything and everything in its path.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the real theme of the film is about alienation, strangers within our midst. You know, how you can, you know, stand outside of a community and yet be a part of it, and how you can try and come into community and impose your way of doing things on them, and how that's usually not going to work out for everyone's benefit.
Go figure.
So to me, that's really what the film is about. I mean, I consider this, Hell or High Water for me was a masterpiece. This is a half a step down from a masterpiece, still a very, very good film.
That's a quote that won't be in the ad campaign. Half a masterpiece.
I said half a step down.
Half a step down. So I would say in this is probably third, which isn't bad, behind Sicario and Hell or High Water.
I would put Sicario at below this one. But, okay. Yeah, I really like Wind River a lot. Terrific film. I hope it
looks great. I mean, it's cold.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm like, you know, literally the cold, the mountain, it's another character in the film. A lot of great pieces of pull-out dialogue that you can put in this. But one I remember is Hope Don't Live Out Here.
Yep. And there's a really brutal moment at the end that's just, pardon the pun, it's cold. It's a cold move. Okay, also out on video, Atomic Blonde, or as I like to call it, John Wick's slightly younger sister.
Yeah, and for me, better than the John Wick movies.
Really? Better than John Wick?
Yeah, just because, I mean, they're all about showcasing stunts, you know, both films directed by longtime stunt coordinator
David Leitch,
and Torino, as with the John Wick movies. And I thought did stuff I haven't seen the John Wick movies. Like, there's a fight scene where Charlize Theron, which takes place in a stairwell where they're like going up and down the stairwell. They're going up, they're going down. There's a point where like they're doing like, you know, barrel rolls. The camera stays with her every single step of the way. Where I'm sitting like, how did they shoot that?
Well, I think I have an answer. One, I think it is kind of if you were to combine John Wick with that particular scene, John Wick with the multi-floor sequence in John Woo's Hard Boiled, set in the hospital. But there's a couple moments where they hit a stairwell or a wall, and I went, "That's the Birdman slash rope cut."
Yeah,
like so. But I know what it, I mean. It's a big showcase in the center of the film. Theron play. It's set in Europe, Berlin, right after the wall gets torn down.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's a combination of Charlize Theron sitting in a room with talking points by Toby Jones and John Goodman, and then her on assignment, especially being chased one way, shape, or form by James McAvee. And so it's that kind of assassin story because it's 1989, a lot of blue sheen gloss and 80s music, so you're going to love the soundtrack. And there's some very cool stunts in it. But that one is probably the reason to rent the film is the big one. I think I still like John Wick better.
Yeah, I mean, I realize it's a contrary opinion, but
less cuts in John Wick, I guess.
And the John Wick movies did very well at the box office, and Atomic Blonde did not do kind of so well, and I suspect part of that is just because certain, you know, dude bros don't want to watch a woman kick butt.
I would say from a different knuckle-dragging dude bro, here's Charlize Theron kicking butt with long hair and, you know, more suggestive clothing as opposed to Mad Max Fury Road. Because men are simple. Men are really simple for their tastes, especially if you have a love of butt-kicking females, like my imaginary security crew when I become famous.
Yeah, some are, some aren't. Hashtag right. Not all men.
Not all men. So, also out on DVD and Blu-ray, Nut Job 2, for those who ask for that. And then you saw Brigsby Bear.
Oh, I love. If I was making my top 10 list this year, for right now, and Lady Bear was number two, Brigsby Bear would be number three. I think, who is it? Bob, our friend, Bob actually.
Bob Bloom.
Bob Bloom. I think he actually told me he would put it number one right now.
Wow.
So a fellow traveler there. I don't even know how to describe this film, but it's so wonderful. It's smart. It's funny. It's heartfelt. At first, when I thought it was going to be a really jokey, ironic, you know, sort of making fun of the characters who are in it while you're watching them. And it's not that at all. Kyle Mooney, is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
Is the star. He was in some TV thing that I don't know because I don't watch TV much anymore. But he also co-wrote the screenplay. And the basic setup without – I'm trying not to give away too much is this, you know, man boy of about 30 years old who lives a very isolated existence. Mark Hamill plays his dad, who's very loving and yet distant in some way. Great, great role and performance for Mark Hamill. And basically his entire world is centered around this cheap, silly kids TV show called Brigsby Bear that has this bear doing like life lessons and has all sorts of, you know, characters and supporting story, has a villain that he opposes named Sun Snatcher. And so without, again, giving, I'm trying to be very careful and not give away the film's, you know, glories, but he comes to go out of that isolated existence and embrace a larger community of people where he's very himself isolated and cut off and doesn't know what to do. And he uses the TV show as his entree into that world to reach out to other people and have real relationships that he's lacked before. And it's just a wonderful, beautiful film. I mean, it is funny and it is goofy on some level, and yet it has very true feelings to it and emotions of this man, you know, trying to reach out to others.
There you go. Also on video is Unlocked, another action film by Michael Apted after doing a Bond film with Noomi Rapace.
Unfortunately, very generic title to the point where it's like, where I saw it was coming out, I was like, have I seen that? And I was like, oh yeah, I saw it and wrote a whole review of it.
Orlando Bloom, Toni Collette, John Malkovich, Michael Douglas. Pretty good cast, and not a lot of people got to see it.
Yeah, and it's a pretty, not great, but a decent
rental.
Spy crime thriller procedural.
Spy things happen. And the old title this week on Blu-ray, you know you want it on Blu-ray, thanks to Criterion, Jean-Pierre Melville's Le Samurai with the great Alain Delon. So if you like cool, in fact, we just talked about cool assassin action movies, this one's one of the grandfathers of it. So that is out there. We're doing all right on time, hanging out with Chris Lloyd here at the Film Yap. The Tibbs Drive-In is still open. It's the weekend before Thanksgiving, and you can still go to the drive-in in Indiana. Good for you.
Good for you.
So, screen one, Thor and Jigsaw.
Didn't see Jigsaw.
That's so somebody did. They screened that for us.
No. Unfortunately, the horror films just don't get screened at all.
Oh.
It's become like Tyler Perry. It's just like, it's like this whole delivery system for people who like that thing, and it just sort of bypasses the normal cinematic outlets and estuaries.
Screen two, Daddy's Home 2, and Only the Brave.
Only the Brave, I liked a lot. Not great, but really terrific Josh Brolin performance in this.
Uh-huh.
And it's about fired.
Firefighters.
Yeah, there's a term for that, but basically outdoor wildfire firefighters. They only do, and it's a very special thing. And it's all about truth, based on the true story of, you know, they're sort of literally like the top line guys that do this, and then there's everyone else's second tier, and this is about a second tier team undertaking the path to become the top tier guys, and then they go from there. And Miles Teller is also in it.
Sorry.
Yeah, Teller is also in it, playing like this sort of like the young scrappy guy.
Jeff Bridges, Jennifer Connelly. Decent cast. Not a lot of people saw it.
Really kind of just died at the box office, and I thought deserved a better audience. Josh Brolin plays this really unique character, sort of the resident, you know, overseer of the team. And, you know, we get to learn a little bit more about him that ends up surprising us. So I think a good film that kind of got ignored.
Screen three. Oh, jeez. A Bad Mom's Christmas and Tyler Perry's Boo 2.
Yeah.
Sure.
Again, the films that just sort of... I never saw the first Bad Moms movie.
Really?
No.
Where they do things bad in slow motion with hip-hop playing?
Yeah. I've asked people something that's like, okay, you know, they say, oh, it's a raunchy movie. I'm like, okay, how raunchy is it really?
If it were truly raunchy, it'd be NC-17.
Yeah.
Screen four, Murder on the Orient Express and The Mountain Between Us, which I don't imagine seeing at a drive-in, but there's
another one they did not screen for us, which was disappointing.
That's a bummer.
With those two stars, Idris Elba and Kate Winslet. Wow.
Mark your calendars at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. December 1st and 2nd, you can see Home Alone and A Christmas Story outside.
Oh, wow. So that'll probably be a good double bill.
We'll see how the weather goes on that one. At the Historic Art Craft Theater. Again, if you're listening to the show on Saturday, thank you. At 7:30 tonight and 2 p.m. tomorrow, the original Miracle on 34th Street with Maureen O'Hara and John Payne. November 24th and 25th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. and 2 o'clock on Sunday the 26th, the original Home Alone. Gee, I wonder where to get these prints. Christmas Story, Friday and Saturday, December 1st and 2nd at 2 and 7:30 p.m. and December 3rd at 2 p.m. And then a radio production of It's a Wonderful Life, Tuesday, December 5th. I got to direct a version of that. Very happy about that. So check that out. And then December 8th and 9th and December 10th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Friday and Saturday, and Sunday at 2 p.m., White Christmas. So that's pretty good down at the Historic Art Craft Theater. Over at IU Cinema, Saturday at 3 o'clock from 1948, Night Song, if you can haul tail down the Bloomington that fast. At 7 o'clock, The Unknown Girl is part of the International Art House series. That's also being shown Sunday the 19th at 6:30 p.m. Sunday the 19th at 3 p.m., the 1955 Western Timberjack, which sounds like something you should do in Reeling Back.
I haven't seen that one.
Monday the 27th, Sunflower Occupation at 7 p.m. They got Thanksgiving off. And then Thursday, November 30th, and Friday, December 1st at 7 p.m., just added, and this is a film that might make my top 10, the documentary Faces Places.
Really?
Yeah, I really dug. It's two different visual artists going around France in a truck, which is also a giant photo booth, and they're photographing regular people and ballooning them up and putting them on the sides of buildings.
Yeah.
And it's, you get to learn more about the subjects as far as the people who live and that are the art, the subjects of the art, as well as two, like a 20 something and an almost 80 something artist. So it on paper sounds like a rom, you know, it's a Buddy Road picture, but it's much more than that and really cool artwork. So that is happening Saturday, December 2nd, Dear Mandela at 3 o'clock, and The Passion of Joan of Arc from 1928 on Sunday, December 3rd. Okay. We got about less than 8 minutes. So I guess, but I know in the Film Yap recently, you talked about Bite the Bullet, and this was a road movie, a race movie, before Cannonball Run.
Yeah.
This was in one era of the Gumball Rally, this, and Death Race 2000. But this is a Western race film.
Yeah, which I had not... So my genesis, if you read the column, is that turns out I had seen a piece of this film many, many, many years ago when I was a little kid. Probably saw it like my dad had it on HBO or something. And it has this great, iconic scene at the end where at the end of this race, Gene Hackman... who is this interesting guy who is sort of an, you know, anti-Western hero, in that, you know, he eschews competition and he doesn't really like the idea of a race, but he loves horses, loves animals, and he sort of goes along more or less just to protect the horses from the people that are riding them. And he has this great scene at the end where has ended up first at the finish line, and he in slow motion gets off of his horse, which is completely lathered and exhausted, and gets at his canteen and quenches both of their thirst, gives the horse a drink before he takes a drink himself. And it's all done in very slow-mo. It's heart-rending. It's very wrenching to watch them both suffering. And I had that little snippet of that piece of cinema in my head. I didn't know what movie it went with. And then I saw Bite the Bullet recently, and I realized, you know, it got fit back into that cinematic jigsaw puzzle, lost piece that got put back in there. And it's a very interesting, very good film, I think.
Yeah.
There really is almost no story to it other than the race.
Right.
And these races was based on real things they did around the turn of the century, where they would have people go race 500 miles on horseback over the course of several days.
And in this case, James Coburn, Jan Michael Vincent, Candace Bergen.
Yeah, really great cast. And Ben Johnson is in it.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, the name of the film comes from a character who never really gets his name. He's just known as the Mexican, because that's what all the other people call him. Interesting, he's sort of derided more by the people watching the race and organizing the race than the people in the race. Within the racers themselves treat each other with a tremendous amount of respect. Like, the Candace Bergen character is the only... She's a real novelty that there's a woman in our race. And yet, the other racers treat her pretty well. You know, it's just like they treat her as just another racer.
Mm-hmm.
And the title, Bite the Bullet, comes from the fact that the Mexican has a very bad tooth. They end up doing some very sort of nasty ad hoc dentistry out on the race. That's where we get the title there.
This is also the film directed by, I think it's the last really good film from Richard Brooks.
Yeah, it was a mid-century writer-director I think has kind of gotten forgotten a little bit.
Deadline USA, The Last Time I Saw Paris, Blackboard Jungle, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Elmer Gantry, Sweet Birdie Youth,
yeah,
The
really,
Professionals.
I mean, the filmography is,
In Cold Blood.
You know, you can put them up there with just about anybody from that working in the, you know, 40s through 60s, 70s. And yet, I don't think his name kind of gets brought up as one of the great directors of that era.
Don't forget that. All right, we have time for Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Writer Robert Getchell, who is right out of the gate, received two Academy Award nominations for his screenplays. His first two screenplays were Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and his follow-up was Bound for Glory.
Wow.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
And other credits include... He did do the screenplay for Mommy Dearest, as well as Sweet Dreams. One of your fans. Sweet Dreams, the Jessica Lange film of Patsy Cline. Stella, the Bette Midler film. Point of No Return, This Boy's Life, and his last screenplay, 1994, The Client, doing the John Grisham adaptation.
Oh,
so
yeah.
not a bad career there, a little bit. Now, we have a tribute with audio. Film composer Luis Bacalov, originally from Buenos Aires, but did a number of spaghetti westerns. And this is a reminder, there's more to spaghetti westerns than Ennio Morricone and Sergio Leone. And yes, you have to actually give credit to Quentin Tarantino, because he brought this guy's work probably to more audience members than the original. But he is best known probably for this piece of music. The original 1966 Sergio Carbucci film Django, starring Franco Nero, who of course had the cameo in Django Unchained. But his music was also used in Kill Bill 1 and 2. In fact, one of the films that he's known for is a spaghetti western with Lee Van Cleef called The Grand Duel. And here's a piece of that music. Everybody's going to, like, Kill Bill and finding out what scene that is in. But that's from 1972, The Grand Duel. He received two Academy Award nominations, one for The Gospel According to St. Matthew, and then in 1996, he won for the score of Il Postino.
Oh, boy.
So, salute. Very cool. And now, go out and find some spaghetti westerns of that era that are not just done by Sergio Leone.
All right.
So, what's happening over at the Film Yap? We got about a minute left.
We've got some, I'm trying to remember, it's hard for me to always remember the reeling backwards lineup because I'm working 2-3 months ahead.
Of course.
Did I have, Seven Men from Now ran not too long ago with, Randolph Scott, kind of a forgotten cowboy
actor. You'll do it
actor.
For Randolph Scott.
But really, so really, really the sort of the, you know, like the character that, in The Hero, that he plays in that film from this year is sort of, to me, kind of based on a Randolph Scott type of character.
Yep.
And so I ended up doing his last film, Ride the High Country, which is one of Sam
Love Ride. His, one of his first films.
Yeah, one of his first, one of the ones that people really remember, and also So it's going to be the last film of Randolph Scott and the last film of Joel McRae, although Joel McRae ended up kind of doing a few other little picture, little parts and little pictures here and there.
Of course. All right, words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz is spoken. Go check out film, Chris at the Film Yap and, of course, on Indie Style Friday mornings. Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure, as always.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon to Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Minnesota. Minnesota? Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
There are clouds in the sky, and they are gray. You may be sad, but remember, they'll all soon pass away. Oh, Jenga, after the showers, the sun will be shining.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!